Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum. And we're pleased to have Jonathan Lejard. So he's a journalist who has been all over the world, and he's even been to Texas. In fact, he covered George Bush in Texas. So we'll have to talk a little bit about that, I think. Right?
Okay.
But along with that, he's been to Eastern Europe, Afghanistan, and most recently, Africa. Given that you've been to so many places, one of the first things I really wanted to ask you was, what is it like to now be in Africa after being in Eastern Europe, Afghanistan, Texas? How does... for Americans, I think so often, Africa really is a kind of dark continent, and it's a place that people don't know a lot about. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, thanks for having me, Laura, and thank you for being here. It's really a great honor. Africa. I think one thing which jumps out is that we're always talking about a continent. We very rarely talk about Europe. You know, I'm a Europe correspondent, or I'm a Asia correspondent, or even a Latin America. But we're always talking about Africa, lumping it all together. Africa, I think the diversity of Africa surprised me, shocked me. Even though I traveled and reported pretty much everywhere else in the world, I'd never been to Africa before I was sent there for The Economist. And I had all the stereotypes and all the thoughts that people have before they go there. And, you know, one of the first revelations is simply, I live in Kenya. I'm sure some people here have been to Kenya. Even Kenya is an incredibly diverse country, you know, with 20 different nationalities, 80 different languages, and completely diverse ecosystems. And, you know, if you compare the Muslim Swahili coast with the Pentecostal Baptist Kikuyu Highlands, and then you get up to Lake Victoria with its infestation of malaria, and it's just extraordinarily rich continent in that way. I think journalistically the main difference from other stories I've reported before is this very peculiar dynamic in Africa that we just simply do not have enough space to write about it. I think The Economist does a pretty good job of covering Africa compared with a lot of other news mediums. But still, any of you that read The Economist know that we lump Africa in with the Middle East. And sometimes if there's a suicide bombing in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, or, you know, someone sneezes in the Knesset, That's the end of your story for that week in Africa, you know? And it's really frustrating in that sense. But on the other hand, it's really kind of sobering place to work, because the stories that you're dealing with are so consequential, whether they're good news stories or bad news stories. They're always involving millions of people. Like, I'm just now working on a cover story which should come out in June about women in Africa. And my basic thesis is, if we focus on women, I mean, everyone kind of knows this intuitively, but somehow it never actually happens. But if we invest in women in terms of microfinance, you can really see real returns. And, you know, when I was reporting in Europe or in the States for The Economist, you know, you write stories, they're kind of important, but they're here today, gone tomorrow. But a story like this, I'm very sober in writing it, because I know that if you get it right, or sort of right, you can really have a huge impact on millions of people's lives. So that's the sort of upside, yeah.
Of covering Africa. Well, you know, one of the things I heard you were on KQED this week, and you were very optimistic in a way about Africa, which was different, because usually what we hear about Africa here in the United States is very dark. But you had this very upbeat opinion about it, particularly economically, about the possibilities. And I wondered if you could talk a little about why you have this more upbeat view of it, because we do hear so often about the wars, about the famine, about all these dark things that go on in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I'm equally upbeat and downbeat. There are tremendous positive forces in Africa, tremendous ingenuity. I mean, anyone who's been in a slum in Africa, or obviously in Latin America or somewhere else, but we're talking about Africa now, you know, it's tough to survive in a slum. You have to be so bloody entrepreneurial just to get by in a slum. You know, it's not like, you know, anyone's offering you a job or are there any possibilities out there. You have to go out and just make enough money to survive. So there is a tremendous energy there, ingenuity, which is ready to be harnessed. And what we see now in the more advanced African economies is that China in particular, but also India, are moving in very rapidly, you know, and very aggressively. And in some countries, they're interested only in the natural resources. They want the agricultural products. They want the minerals. Sometimes they want oil. But in other countries, they're just actually looking for markets. 900 million people is 900 million people. And even if they don't have much purchasing power, they're getting more purchasing power. Yeah. So there are tremendous business opportunities there. And if you talk to anyone who's involved with business in Africa, you have to be tough. And you really have to deal with corruption. And you can deal with it either with integrity and being strong and standing up, or which is, can be very painful and you know, long-lasting kind of process. Or you can deal with it by, you know, paying off ministers and civil servants to get your contracts. But the point is, those companies which do stick it out in Africa, their margins are unbelievably high. You're talking about, for a business in the States which have a 5% profit margin, in Africa you're looking at minimum of 30%. Huh. Yeah. And unfortunately, especially here in the States, but also in the European Union, executives are outside of the oil and gas industry are not really willing to rough it. I don't really know why that is, because I know when they were younger, they were quite happy roughing it. But now it's very hard to get American executives into Africa unless there's a Sheraton and an airport that works, you know. And that's just the wrong attitude to do business in Africa, you know. But the key point to get across is that across the board, if American companies or European companies don't invest in Africa now, the Chinese will buy it up on the cheap. And believe me, the Chinese will not care about human rights, transparency, good governance in the slightest. They're not interested. And this is why British, American, Italian, French intelligence services are working to investigate Chinese investments in Africa, because they're very worried that they're undermining rather feeble attempts by Western countries to improve the levels of governance and so on. But basically, I would put the chances for most African countries at 60-40. 60% likely to take off, 40% likely to remain in stasis or collapse. But
you actually said when we were talking before that, in fact, though, there were success stories in mm-hmm. Africa, that there were areas where you really did see people thriving. Which areas would you say there are, you see this, maybe that hope? And I'm not sure if the 60-40 is the 60 who will make it or the 60 who won't make it.
No, they'll make it. I mean, mm-hmm. I think 60%, I mean, it's maybe a little bit simplistic to put it in those terms, but if we're talking about Africa as a continent, I think, you know, 60-40 is a fair equation. But, you know, businesses which are really taking off at the moment, mobile phones or cell phones, as you say here in the States, that's really booming in Africa now. You find even in very poorest communities, in rural villages, people have access to a cell phone. They may not own it themselves. Maybe the sort of the block of shambas or huts together, they have a mobile phone. And in the villages, it's really weird and kind of fascinating how the market provides for these dynamic. But they, you know, they have cell phones and they have cell phone coverage, but they don't have any electricity. So they actually have a guy on a bicycle. You'll see it in Tanzania or somewhere. There's a guy on a bicycle in the village of 4,000 people, and his job is to cycle that bicycle all day, and people bring their cell phones and plug them in, and he's generating the power for it. You know?
It's certainly better for the environment. Maybe we should start that, you know, here to stop global warming. You know, the thing, though, that I can't help thinking when you talk about the West should go into Africa, the Chinese are going there, and they don't care about human rights. But if you look at the history of the West in Africa, one can't exactly say we've cared much about human rights or democracy either. And even most recently, if you look at the Congo, which has the world's largest deposits of coltan. And coltan, if people don't know, is actually used to make cell phones and silicon chips. And the companies that have gone in there, my understanding is that they pay off the rebel groups who were and finance the civil war in order to make our cell phones. And so I wonder, do you think there's another possibility, or do you see some other way for Western investment to actually really profit the people who live in Africa?
Well, I think the important point here is to clearly distinguish between extractive industries and industries which are perhaps agricultural or even service orientated. I mean, clearly, when you're talking about extractive industries, Africa still has a problem, still has an issue. The issue is twofold, and the issue is unscrupulous Western companies which knowingly deal with unscrupulous middlemen and knowingly dealing with ministers and governments which they know should be rotten, and in Congo's case, worse than rotten. But, you know, I wouldn't like to emphasize that overly much. I feel like in the States and in Europe, I'm not underplaying it, but I would say that Kenya, Ethiopia, Tanzania make more money from selling roses to the European Union. But, you know, Valentine's Day, 70% of the roses in Europe are grown in Eastern Africa, you know. And if you go to Nairobi Airport or Addis Ababa Airport or Dar es Salaam or Arusha, any of those airports, you'll see huge jumbo jets, which are just full of roses every day. And they're air freighted to Europe. And that's worth a lot of money, you know. And that's employing a lot of people because it's very sort of labor intensive. And there are lots of industries like that which are just sort of taking off, and they're becoming unionized, particularly for women. It's very good news because it's very hard for African women to make a wage, and that leaves them open to abuse and not being able to educate their children and so on and so forth. So I don't want to underplay the oil and gas thing, but I do think, particularly here in the States, there's perhaps too much emphasis on that and not enough emphasis on sort of day-to-day business. I mean, here in the Bay Area, and when you get up to Seattle, we're in the kind of coffee belt of the U.S. here, yeah? And I sat on the plane back from Addis Ababa the other week with a lady from Oakland who was the chief buyer for Pete's Coffee, you know, which I guess is a local chain here. And she was very bullish about the coffee industry in Africa, you know. And they're paying premium prices, much higher than Latin American growers get. You know, schools are getting built. I mean, we're starting from a very low base in rural Africa, you know. But basically, I think some things are going in the right direction, you know. But obviously, there are a lot of alarm signals as well, which we can...
Well, you know, I'm thinking here we are, we're sort of in Silicon Valley, it's all here, and there's all this venture capital money. And I think, you know, most of these people do, in fact, travel to Europe, and they're traveling first class. And how would one convince them to go to go to Africa, to take some of that money and that vision and desire for startups and get them to Africa? What would you say to them? Where would you say you should invest?
Which parts of Africa are the best investment right now? That's
really awesome. And how would you, you know, convince some of these people that it's worthwhile? Because as you were saying, the Chinese are going in and they're investing. And what about people from here? Why, you know, they're not?
Well, I think it's a little. I think there are actually quite a few philanthropists and social entrepreneurs coming out of the tech industry in. Not as many as there should be, frankly, given the capitalization which took place here. But you know, Bill Gates is a hero. He's an absolute hero. And so is Melinda Gates. They, you know, when you sit down with them, you talk about Africa with them, they fundamentally understand it, fundamentally. And they really picked some key issues which will save millions of children's lives. And they still can't spend their money fast enough, you know, because they obviously have to divest the funds every year, and it's a struggle for them in that sense. But they, you know, I think there are tremendous opportunities, particularly in microfinance. I think that's an area where the base of the pyramid in the States is maybe this wide. In Africa, it's enormous, you know, and the middle class. The trick in Africa is to try and move some of that base of the pyramid to the middle class, you know. And any country that is managing to do that is a country that's becoming more democratic, more open, more globalized, more, you know, more dynamic, and frankly, is creating a lot more jobs, you know. And that's one point which is often missed in the discussion about Africa. If we had some of my African friends here, they would emphasize jobs. You know, everyone's talking about corruption, crime, drought. All these things are really important. But the key question is jobs. You have to provide jobs. One reason you have so much corruption in African governments is people are desperate to get jobs for their brothers, their cousin. You know. I went to visit a friend the other day in Nairobi who 2 years ago, the gardener of my friend had asked me if I would employ his brother. You know, so my wife and I interviewed his brother, and well, you know, he really wasn't up for the job. So we said, well, thank you, but I really hope you get a job. You know, and then I just mentioned it to this gardener when I was back. 2 years later, does your brother have a job? He must have a job. No, he hasn't worked in the last 2 years, you know? Not at all. And that's so common, you know? And such a huge issue, especially in an urbanized environment, which is getting more expensive, more difficult to live, more crime-ridden. Unless you're going to produce the jobs for working-class people, you know, it's going to collapse, you know?
I don't want to dwell too long on this, but for people in the audience who perhaps don't know what microfinance is, because you've used the term a couple of times, and it has been a big thing. We had a Nobel Prize winner who really was a real starter in microfinance, but if you could just explain to people a little bit about what that is.
Well, I think it's slightly implicit in the word. I mean, it's just very small amounts of money. You have a woman who wants to be a seamstress. You know, somebody needs the dress changed in the slum, or she need, someone's torn a pair of trousers, she can get in like a little sewing machine and a table and a shack, and she can rent the shack for $50 a month, and maybe she might employ someone else to help with her business. And then people just come to her with their clothes that need mending and so on and so forth. So what she needs, really, is a loan of about $200, $300. And for a long time, there really hasn't been enough serious thinking about how to... I mean, I think we've known for a long time that it's very important to get that money, but how to manage those sums and how to move that money... Mm. And technology is actually helping with that now. In several African countries, it's now possible to get a microfinance loan over your mobile phone. So the money will actually come into your mobile phone.
Wow.
Then you go to an outlet which sells the cards, your charge-up cards, you know. And they will then have you give the PIN number or whatever. If someone's texted you the PIN number, then you get the money. And that's a very, very efficient private sector way of delivering small sums of money to large numbers of people. And so I think technology is starting to kick in there. And basically, if you can get those sums out to people, particularly, as they say, to women, and something which I've been looking at a lot, because women take care of about 80% of children in Africa, often as single mothers, or especially as grandmothers, you know. I mean, there's such a dysfunctionality, or in one respect, or a communal living in another respect. But, microfinance, it's going to be a key issue there.
I did want to bring up Darfur. I'm going to sort of switch for a minute here. But we were talking about corruption and the difficulties in Africa, and... something you had talked about just before, we were talking about the movie Blood Diamond, in which there's kind of a line about everybody kind of being out for themselves, and how much you thought about that being the problem in Africa. And I was thinking about Darfur and what's going on there.
Darfur is obviously, and obviously here in the States, you read a lot about Darfur, and then you understand that probably better than any issue in Africa, simply because American newspapers are prepared to invest a lot of capital in getting stories out of there. It's obviously a political issue in terms of control of Khartoum. But underneath that is an environmental issue as well. Now, I don't want to suggest that the whole thing is environmental, but I do think this is a key point to get across and for people to register. I mean, Darfur, to me, is like the miner's bird, you know, the canary in the mine, the coal mine, which is warning us of what's going to happen across large parts of dry Africa. I mean, broadly speaking, you can divide Africa into dry and wet. And wet Congo has incredible problems and incredible violence, but hunger is not one of their problems, and water is not one of their problems. And even when every social and political and governance system breaks down in Congo, as it has, people don't starve, you know. They got bananas, avocados, papayas, you know, growing everywhere. In the dry part of Africa, which runs in the belt from Mauritania on the Atlantic Ocean through Darfur and then down through Ethiopia, through Somalia, northern Kenya to the Indian Ocean, this area is an incredible problem. And it has the highest population growth in the world, the lowest human indicators in every respect, the highest infant mortality, the highest maternal mortality, the lowest literacy rates, the lowest life expectancy. Also, it has the highest percentage of small arms per capita in the planet. So one doesn't And at the same time, the climate change is having a massive effect in this region. You know, the water sources are drying up, the rainfall is becoming more volatile, cattle, goats, camels dying. People are pastoralists on the whole, and their lifestyle is collapsed basically. And underlying the Darfur question is the fact that nomadic Janjaweed were competing for the same grazing grounds that settled villagers wanted for their goats and for their animals. And, you know, it's spiraled out of control, and it's got very mushy and complicated after that, with obviously different rebel factions and so on. But underlying it is a fundamental question that Darfur simply cannot sustain the number of people that are living there. You have like 2.7 million people minimum on the international payroll. There is no solution, none, nothing on the table which will get those people off food aid or get them going. If you look at the Abuja Peace Declaration, economic development was mentioned in one paragraph on page 16. Now that's madness, you know. I'm sorry, it's just complete and utter madness that you'll get a peace accord, but what are people going to do? How are they going to recover their wells? How are they going to run their animals? So I'm very, even though I'm positive by and large about wet Africa, I'm incredibly apocalyptic about dry Africa. And Darfur is just going to be the first of many examples. Simply put, the international community will not, is not, and it will not step up to the base on Darfur.
I was going to ask you, what is there something that the international community can actually do? There's a lot of talk about it in this
country.
Oh, there's
a lot they can do, but what they will do is nothing. They're going to obfuscate, and there'll be a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of New York Times editorials, but there won't actually be anything substantive for those people. It's just not going to happen.
What would, if there was something that could happen, what would it be?
Well, I think obviously the key question is to put a lot of pressure on China, which is the sole sort of protector of Sudan and the Security Council. And I would argue for a boycott of the Beijing Olympics for a start. You know, I think that would be a very effective, because you know Sudan is worth something to China, but it's not worth the Beijing Olympics to them. You know, it really isn't. Yeah. They would drop Sudan in a heartbeat if they knew that the Western community was serious about punishing them in that sense. That's the only leverage we have over Sudan, to be honest.
What is Sudan worth to China? I mean, I think that's a good question. I don't know that much about the investment that China
has. It's oil and gas. It's a very useful source of oil and gas. Most of the oil investment in South Sudan, and a lot of it still hasn't been tapped, is Chinese. And obviously the attendant infrastructure in terms of roads, everything that the Sudanese are building now. If anyone's been to Khartoum recently, you'll see Chinese skyscrapers all over the city. Pretty big ones, you know. It's a big benefit. It's worth several, $10, maybe $10, $20 billion to the Chinese. But in the scheme of international condemnation, they probably would back off.
So there isn't, because there are people in this country who are very angry with the Bush administration for not doing enough.
Yeah, not just in this country.
Yes, I would say that's probably true.
We could be here for a long time criticizing the Bush administration. I wouldn't say on Darfur they've been that aberrant, actually. I think they've actually pushed the process. They airlifted the AU troops in there. They're basically paying for the AU to be there. I think they can do more, but I wouldn't really wag the finger at the Bush administration on Darfur. I think it's a systemic problem. The bottom line is there are large regions of arid parts of Africa which are collapsing, which are flooded with guns, where people are desperate and living in a sub-medieval environment, and the amount of aid which all Western and international community in general is willing to donate to turn that around is a fraction of what's needed. And it's not even clear to me that even if the money was forthcoming, that one would know how to spend it effectively, you know?
You know, I want to make sure that we of course talk a bit about your fiction writing. All of this that you cover in Africa and all that you've covered everywhere, of course, is, I'm sure, fodder for your fiction. And I just had the pleasure of reading Giraffe, which is, if you haven't read it, it's a really wonderful novel. And a lot of what you've covered in Afghanistan, in Africa, there's been a lot of suffering in these places. And I guess I just wondered first, you know, how you sort of mix up what you have been reporting on with also being a fiction writer.
Mm. Well, I should first of all say that, I take fiction very... I mean, that's my first love, you know. That's my passion, and that's what I really... I mean, I'm very privileged to be a foreign correspondent. It's very important to me. But fiction is something more. It's me. I think for those of you who don't know, that this novel, Giraffe, it's a little bit misleading because one would think it's all set in Africa. We're going to talk about Africa. It starts off in Africa, but actually it's about communist Eastern Europe. And it's based on a true story that I happened to hear about by coincidence from a former retired secret police officer in former Czechoslovakia, who told me that, you know, 1975, there was a one zoo in Czechoslovakia that had the largest herd of giraffes ever held in captivity in any zoo before or since. And that in 1975, the secret police shot them all dead and then covered it up and made it a national secret. And it's actually still officially a state secret in the Czech Republic, even, 17 years after communism. And I was utterly fascinated in the story, and I spun the story out into a novel. But I think the point I wanted to get to answer your question is that I've been a lot of times a war correspondent, and I've seen people get blown up, I've seen people get killed, I've seen really things that I wouldn't like to tell my children that I've seen. And in this novel, the suffering happens to these animals, to these giraffes. Mm-hmm. And what I was really fascinated in and wanted to get at was just to examine one single suffering, one single moment of suffering, and to turn it this way and that, not in a melodramatic way, but in a genuinely emotional way. And I felt that human suffering was too big, you know, for me. It was too... I had to tune it down to another level. When I was a student, I lived in Helsinki in Finland for a summer. And I worked briefly for a Finnish filmmaker called Aki Kaurismäki, who some of you film buffs probably know. He's a great European film director. But Aki, especially being Finnish, the Finns don't like to talk very much. And he starts off one of his films, The Match Factory Worker. It's about a girl who works in a factory to make matches. And it's 20 minutes before somebody says a single word in the film. And I asked Aki about it, and he said that when you when you tune the level down enough, then even striking a match is explosive. And I never really forgot that, you know. And I think in this novel, rather than depict, you know, an atrocity, you know, Srebrenica or something you want to seem, I really wanted to just examine the suffering of these animals and of these people who had to shoot the animals and had to bury them. And it was such a bizarre, otherworldly kind of story, you know.
In the novel, there's a couple references to, I think, being joined by our suffering and our joy. And, you know, that struck me as probably with all the things you have seen as a foreign correspondent in various places to probably, you must feel that deeply.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I think it's quite a humanistic notion. I don't see it as a negative notion. I see it quite the contrary. I think joy is often contained within oneself, within one's family and friends, within one's clique, except perhaps, you know, in sporting events or something like that. But, you know, suffering, you know, that's something we all share. And if we meditate on that, then I think that brings us much closer together, you know.
I actually did want to ask you to read just a short passage from the book, if you have that there, or open up, which the book takes place largely in Czechoslovakia in the early 1970s, when it is still part of the Soviet Union. And it's kind of a... I guess the book has a... It's kind of a melancholy book, although not totally tragic either. There's a melancholy to it.
It's definitely melancholy, but I mean, I'm not depressive, you know. You know, I mean, one writer, I don't know if any of you have read W.G. Sebald, but Sebald was a writer who meant a lot to me, and I'm obviously not saying I copy him or would even hope to emulate him, but that kind of mood, you know, sort of Kafkaesque, slightly. And I should just say, before reading this passage, this period, you're saying it's the early 70s. Remember in 1968, the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia. From about 65 to 68, Czechoslovakia tried to become kind of a Sweden from the left. And eventually Moscow lost patience and moved in. And what happened after then was a period called normalization, the Russians called it, in which any moderate was expelled from the Communist Party and the country became very brutalized. And it was a very desperate period. There were no, from 69 to 75, there were no dissidents in Czechoslovakia at all. They were gone. They had no hope. And so this is the period in which this passage is set. This is my Czechoslovakia, which is caught in a spell of normalization, darkened like an insect colony under the shadow of a stone. So reduced and forgetting that only crows remember the old patterns and lift from the branches of the same trees as crows in the time of the Napoleonic Wars, when there were no factories and no roads, and the journey to Austerlitz took days going and longer coming back. It is nothing like the ice-bound island beyond the Pole Star where the gear falcon hatches, or the mountains of Papua New Guinea, such as the shipping director spoke of, where the air is so thin, the helicopters bringing miners to the gem mines below the glaciers gain no purchase and spin a full circle before regaining control. My country does not teeter on any kind of edge but the edge of self. It knows nothing of Hamburg but what vodniks whisper in pubs. Sorry, I should say a vodnik is a sort of magical... It's kind of like a mermaid that lives in the river. It's this very Slav notion that, you know, you have these little men that live in rivers and river spirits, really. But what Vodniks whisper in pubs, nothing of fictional Emile's Berlin now divided, and nothing of the salt marshes of the English coast where Pip once tended Magwitch, and so unknowingly secured for a time his fortune. Czechoslovakia is the middle of things, a middling totalitarian state in the middle of Europe, where deep drops in barometric pressure are not met by the shifting of ocean currents, but the pressing in of the brain, just here by the temples, a constriction of blood vessels behind the eyes, a certain sudden melancholy and a pain in porous molars. It's the middling roads over middling streams in which the fleck of trout grown so-so under middling rains must be visible to the keen eyes of the giraffes. It's middling Vodniks capturing middling souls and potting them in hollows below middling runs of rushes and reeds. It's middling towns with splendid Baroque churches of limited congregations and middle-sized tower blocks haunted by middling quicklime outlines of the dead and middling factories that never meet the oversized quotas set for them in the commonest moment, and middling villages encircling the towns, where ambitions are no more than those of the Vodnik, that is, to watch over a stretch of river, to preserve souls, and to drink in the pub. Contemplation of my country is enough to bring on nausea, not seasickness, but land sickness. I search the horizon for a sea as a sailor searches for land. I want the meadows to shift under a light swell and the eels to summon up a hurricane from the Sargasso Sea of their memory that might swing the bells in the church towers.
It's a beautiful passage. I want to say in just a few minutes we're going to take some questions from people, so if you have any and you want to think about them, there's a microphone over there that we'll be asking you to step up to ask your questions. It's such a beautiful passage and gives this sense of perhaps what it must have been like in Czechoslovakia at that period. Did you ever spend any time there? I know you've spent time in Prague, you've spent time in Czechoslovakia. Were you there at all in the 70s?
I think it was about that high in the 70s. So. No, I was never there. I mean, I was very, very lucky that the first story I ever wrote for the Scotsman newspaper, I don't know if you have anyone from Scotland here, but Scotsman is like the national newspaper of Scotland, and that was my first job. I was a foreign correspondent for Scotsman, and my first job was I covered the Romanian Revolution in Bucharest. And I wrote quite dreadful stories, I think, just terrible. But it was an amazing moment. It was that moment. So I just caught the very tail end of communism.
You, in order to do this book, which, again, it's about these giraffes and this very strange incident that you heard about where these giraffes are killed. This huge herd of giraffes in the zoo in Prague, I guess, are killed.
Not Prague.
It wasn't Prague. I wasn't sure, actually. I couldn't remember if it was Prague or not. But how did you get people to talk about this incident that had happened so many years ago?
No, it was an amazing experience, especially, obviously, the novel is entirely, it's a novel, it's literature, but based on a true story. And I spent a year and a half going around interviewing people, you know, who had been involved in the incident, even the butchers who butchered these bodies of these giraffes, which was such an absurd and a kind of otherworldly thing. You can imagine a giraffe with reaches from here to the wall there, not the wall, but the bar, certainly, butchering it as a Czechoslovakian butcher in the middle of communism period with the secret police over your shoulder. I mean, it's an incredible story. But the punchline on the story was, after 1.5 years, by complete chance, I met someone who knew someone who knew the guy that actually had been brought in by the secret police to shoot the animals. And I couldn't believe my luck. I just couldn't believe it, because I've been 1.5 years on this, and we were dealing with secret police officers who are just paranoid and very anti-Western, and they're not willing to talk to you, and you have to sort of charm them and get them drunk and all kind of anything you can do, you know. And then we ended up getting this guy's address. So we just doorstopped the poor man. And he was a forester. The reason he'd been brought in by the secret police was that the secret police had tried to shoot the giraffes in the chest. They tried to kill 2 giraffes already. And they shot them in the chest, and it didn't have any effect on the animals, and they died the most horrendous death. And they realized, the veterinarians, that the only way to actually shoot a giraffe is through the temple bone here. It's very thin. So you needed the crack shot, basically. Huh? You needed someone who could really shoot. And they got the best shooter in the district, who happened to be this forester. And they lied to him, they threatened him, they did all kinds of terrible things. And he did it. But anyway, we went to see him, and I've interviewed a lot of prime ministers and politicians, but this was by far the most important and emotional interview I ever did. You know, it was like 4 hours. I said, I've come to speak about it in Czech. I said, I've come to speak about the giraffes. And he said, how did you know? I said, I know. He said, you better come in. And he lived in a little hut in the middle of the forest, you know. And so I went in, and he just talked, you know. And one knew that they would never, ever, ever, ever talk like that again in his life. They just wanted to say it once. And he described everything perfectly. And it was, it was a very incredible moment.
Now, I want to let people in the audience get a chance to ask you some questions. I've had my chance. So I think we have somebody right here by the microphone, perhaps?
Yes. Hi. I want to thank you, first of all, for saying that microfinance is so important, because I think it is one of the ways to eliminate extreme poverty. Thank you for that. My question to you is, I've heard about Bush's proposed African command, similar to the European CENTCOM and other commands he has around the world. If it comes about, do you think it will be for altruistic reasons, like helping Darfur and extending his AIDS assistance, or do you think it will be for stripping the gold, the oil, the diamonds, and other natural resources?
That's a very good question. I think probably neither, actually. I mean, I've been to Djibouti and looked at the U.S. base there. They really are so overstretched. They're very, very poor intelligence. And, you know, it's a very sad state of affairs after the Nairobi and Dar es Salaam embassy bombings that the State Department in Africa, which used to be, frankly, one of the strongest branches of the State Department, is now very weak. And I certainly don't use U.S. diplomats as any kind of source at all on local political intelligence. And I don't expect the military will have any serious impact in Africa, either for good or bad, unfortunately.
We have another question here.
So far this evening, you haven't mentioned religion as a force in Africa now.
Sorry, I didn't catch the first.
Oh, sorry. So far this evening, you haven't mentioned religion as a significant force in Africa now. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the role of religion in Africa.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think what we see, obviously one has to define Francophone Africa, Anglophone, and then predominantly Muslim Africa. But if we look at Anglophone Africa, which obviously has a Muslim minority, what you see is an explosion of a kind of slight mutation on the American, the prosperity gospel, charismatic Christianity, Pentecostalism, Southern Baptist missions, and that they're really taking over from the more established Episcopalian, Presbyterian traditions. I would separate the Catholic Church from that. My personal view is that the Catholic Church gets a very, very bad rap on Africa, which I think is not undeserved, because obviously they have this absurd stand on condoms, which is indefensible. But at the same time, if you genuinely travel in Africa to the poorest regions, the only people that you would see helping the poor are Catholic priests. Really. The orphanages are entirely Catholic. The schools, primary schools, are entirely Catholic. By some estimates, 60% of AIDS patients in the entire continent of Africa are supported by the Catholic Church. So I would really, in the realm of fairness, separate them out from that discussion. Obviously, on birth control and abortion is separate issues. But the Pentecostalist rise, I think, is very worrying, very damaging for large parts of Africa. It's prosperity gospel is no solution for very poorest people, you know? And it's just a business which is exploiting the very poorest people. And actually, you can say clearly in Kenya, where I live, people are more conservative religiously than they were at independence in 1963, you know? And woe betide any gay man or woman in Kenya, you know? They get murdered, raped, burned alive, stoned to death, and it's just pretty barbaric.
I just want to say, I'm supposed to say for the radio audience, that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club Inform program, and we're talking with Jonathan Lejard about Africa Now. And we're going to take another audience question.
Thank you. I'm a vegetarian, and I think of humans as just another species. And I got a sense of a connection between what's happening in Iraq and Darfur and everywhere with the killing of those giraffes. I didn't think of it before. I wondered if you had the same feeling.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. That makes me very happy, because that's exactly the point. I mean, the subtext of the novel was for me to... I mean, if I can put it simply, if you could really understand this suffering, then you would be a little bit more compassionate and you would see the utter horror to a suicide bombing or a child dying of malnutrition. So... yeah, I definitely think that was definitely my goal and my intention, was to create a kind of just an understanding of suffering in an abstract sense. Thank you.
Another question.
Yes, I'd like to go back to your discussion of religion in Africa and the current socially conservative government in the U.S. and the, I would say, gag order on those nonprofits receiving federal funds in Africa not discussing condoms, and what your thoughts and observations has been on that.
No, that's a very good, penetrating question. I think it's really it's a terrible thing that the Bush administration is doing, and it's blindness. It's costing lives on the ground, and the raw fact is that the, and I'm not an anti-religious person. I don't want to come off as someone who's down or not respecting people's right to worship. But these are groups which are going out, and they're telling very poor women, you know, you can't have any birth control. They're telling girls who've been raped that, no, you can't have an abortion. And they're not backing it up in any way in terms of social infrastructure and so on. And, you know, the Bush administration has been lamentable in many respects in Africa. And in this respect, it's proving catastrophic. If you look at just at Uganda as an example, Uganda, in the time of Idi Amin, some of you have seen Last King of Scotland, Uganda had a population of 15 million, maybe 13, 15 million at the time of Idi Amin. It's going to have a population of 120 million by 2030, 2040. You know, and these kind of birth control policies and the gag orders, as you put it, you know, they're very, very detrimental to the poorest people in Africa, and they're just simply indefensible.
Thank you. Another question?
Hi. When I first traveled to Africa this summer, everyone in America was like, be careful.
And where did you go?
Kenya.
Kenya.
And everyone was really, they were like frightened from my traveling mate and I. But all my European friends were like, right on. And all of Kenya and many other parts of Africa that we've heard are filled with Europeans. And I guess my question is, can you explain that kind of schism between perhaps European and American sentiments towards Africa, and if there's anything that us as Americans can do to combat that?
I think the to be fair to the States, one has to say that Latin America is the backyard of the United States in terms of sort of third world backpacking, exotic tourism, and Africa is kind of Europe's backyard. And obviously we have colonial histories, for better or worse, with African countries. But at the same time, I think, the point is slightly more complicated. I think one issue in the States, especially having lived here, is that it's very much harder for college students to take a year out, either before or after college, because you were announcing there was going to be a talk on debt burden. But I think debt burden is it's a really big issue for young Americans. And that's a real shame because, you need a car and you need this and that. You have to pay off your college loans. So, there's less opportunity to go there. But I would say, also in defense of young Americans, the Peace Corps is still very active in Africa, and people who are very interested in Africa can join the Peace Corps. And I've always been very impressed meeting Peace Corps volunteers in rural Senegal or rural Chad or somewhere, and they're really roughing it up, and they know the local tribal language, and that's a tremendous asset to bring back to the States. But my recommendation is always to go. I mean, go with open eyes, be careful, but do explore. Yeah.
I see we have more questions still.
When we think about Africa, it's really easy to think about European imperialism. Yet after many European colonies were, countries turned from European colonies to independent nations.
I think you want to get a little closer to the microphone.
There are still a lot of intractable problems. And I'm wondering, could you speak, say, compare and contrast King Leopold and what he did in the Congo or the Belgian Congo to, say, Mobutu when he was the leader of the Congo? How much of a difference is there?
Well, obviously, in one sense, there's a sea of difference. In another sense, not. I mean, basically, if one reduces it to the simplest level, the African model of colonialism was a very sharp pyramid with a very few Europeans at the top and very brutal all the way down. India was a little bit more, still a pyramid, but a little bit wider base. Congo is probably not the most representative example of African colonialism because it was by far the most egregious example of European exploitation. The Belgians were undoubtedly the most brutal and the worst colonial masters. But clearly, the system of having all authority and wealth at the top is something which has sort of infected post-colonial regimes. Richard Kapuscinski, who, I have issues with, but I think he summed it up very well in one of his essays when he said that basically, the Europeans held on to the banks, to coffee, tea plantations, the rubber plantations, But the Africans moved into the governor's mansions, you know. So basically they had all the structures of power, but none of the economy, you know. And they were not able to build an economy or even to learn how to build an economy. The other day I had supper with in East Africa we have a lot of Asian Africans, mostly of Gujarati extraction, some Ismaili Muslims. And they came with the British in the end of the 19th century to build the railroads and so on. But what was fascinating was his telling me sort of that in East Africa, the reason the railways have collapsed and the post offices collapsed, the roads have collapsed, all that kind of infrastructure has collapsed is because in the British colonial time, the Asians were brought in specifically to cover that middle role. There were the tribal chiefs below and they were doing the agricultural things, British above doing the army and the intelligence and so on. But the Asians were like running the post offices, running the banks. They knew how to do that and they knew how to maintain things. And many of them left to Britain to be replaced by other Asians who didn't have those skills, or in the case of Uganda, were thrown out by Idi Amin. And frankly, those countries haven't recovered in that sense. So it's a very interesting topic. Yeah.
Yes, right here.
You had talked about microfinancing as being the future for South Africa, for Africa. Now, say that if you were an American with $5,000 in your bank account and you want to help, where and how would you about getting started?
Oh, that's a really good question. And it's one my mother asks me all the time. I think the... I'm sure some people might disagree with me here, but just being on the ground in Africa, I would be very suspicious of emotive websites where those NGOs which say, well, your money is going to, you know, Joseph lives in Kibera slum and you're paying for his schooling and so on and so forth. In my experience, those organizations, I'm not saying they're fleecing you, but I don't think they think systemically enough. Though I would do a little bit of research on microfinance. I would lean very strongly towards urban projects. I would lean very strongly towards projects which help women and children in urban areas. I think if you have $5,000 and you want to spend it as judiciously as possible, then that's what I'd be looking for. And I think Save for Children is an NGO which has proved pretty effective. I would not recommend UNICEF on the whole, simply because I think although UNICEF does incredible amounts of good work, they're not very efficient compared with Oxfam or Save for Children or CAFOD or, you know, CARE. These organizations, I think, are a little bit more effective. But if you just think in terms of microfinance, women, children, urban areas, I think that's going to be most effective.
We just have a couple minutes left, but, you know, we were talking before about where you actually live in Africa, and one of the things that strikes me is that it really is a land of contrasts, even where you live. He has four children, so in addition to writing, being a foreign correspondent and a novelist, he's raising four children with his wife. But if you could tell me just a little bit about this area where you actually live and what it looks like and the sort of contrast between the beauty and the...
Well, we live just outside Nairobi on the edge of a national park there. Nairobi is the only city in the world which has a national park. Certainly the only city in Africa which has a national park on its doorstep, and it's quite extraordinary. The slum on one side with 800,000 people, on the other side of the road you've got the national park, which is 20 miles by 20 miles with lions, zebras, giraffes, hippos, and everything else. And our area, funnily enough, I'm sure some of you will be familiar with the Danish writer Karen Blixen and that rather saccharine Owls of Africa, I think it was called, with Robert Redford and Meryl Streep. Quite a dreadful film, but it's a great novel. It's a great novel, you know. But anyway, Karen Blixen, we actually live, our district is called Karen, and it was named after Karen Blixen, and so we actually live on the land that used to belong to her coffee estate. And these are rather large plots of land, and as I mentioned, we actually have a leopard living at the bottom of our garden now, so that's very exotic, you know. And sometimes the Maasai herders, when it's a dry season, they bring their cattle up because they know that all the Musungus, that's the white people, the white Kenyans, they have large gardens. So the Maasai often come up in the dry season with their cattle, and then they ask you, can we bring our cattle into your garden, you know? So then we end up, you know, sitting there with, all, you know, 20 cattle roaming around our garden, you know? But our children very much like that.
I bet they do. But then also you said the city itself is quite poor and difficult.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's poor. I mean, I think the problem is I'm quite in love with architecture. And anyone who's been to sub-Saharan Africa knows that sub-Saharan Africa is not in love with architecture. You know, Nairobi, it's not going to win any beauty prizes. And it's also a very violent city, too. I think that's the... South Africa is yet more violent. But Nairobi is violent. I mean, it's very... there's always an edge when you drive home from a dinner party at night at 11 o'clock. There's always in the back of your mind that you might get carjacked and you might get shot. And because people do. I mean... Our local Catholic priest was shot dead coming back from the Christmas Mass and on Christmas Eve. He'd done the Mass and he was driving home and they shot him dead. So, I mean, there is that sort of side to it, which is very thuggish. And, but, you know, on the other hand, it's a very dynamic city. It's a real diaspora of many, many different African countries. And there are lots of other things which we very much like about it.
Yeah, a lot of great wildlife, you know. Yeah, between you get the, I guess, the hard part of living in a city and the crime on one side and the lions on the other. So it could be a little difficult, right?
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's give a hand to Jonathan Lejard. So now this meeting of Inform, a division of the Commonwealth Club, is adjourned.